for Tuesday, February 19th. And we have two informational hearings today. And the first one is on the Columbia River crossing. So I'm going to put an informational hearing on that and ask Doug Tindall and John Osborne to come forward, please.
For about 10 years.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, good afternoon. Doug Tindall, Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Transportation. Happy to be here today to talk about a critical project for the state of Oregon, the Columbia River Crossing. With me is Project Director from ODOT, John Osborne. And John's going to cover the bulk of the presentation and answer the bulk of the questions because he's closer to it than I am. But let me just start out by framing up this project. We call it the Columbia River Crossing Project. It's effectively what is now the I-5 crossing over the Columbia River. This is a project that is part of an entire corridor. It's been under study and work for more than a decade. There was a freight corridor study done that started in, I believe, 1995 and continued on and identified the Columbia River crossing as one of the bottlenecks on the I-5 corridor. It's not the only one. Other projects that are associated with this corridor, not part of this project, the Delta Park interchange, we just recently awarded the contract on the Oregon side, and Washington has rebuilt an interchange on their side as we try to alleviate the bottlenecks along the entirety of the corridor and not just at the Columbia River crossing. The project, as it crosses between states, is a cooperative effort between ODOT and WSDOT, Oregon and Washington, the cities of Vancouver and Portland, and Metro and the MPO on the Vancouver on the Washington side. So there's a lot of moving parts to this. Obviously, it's been done before because we have the two bridges that are there now. We have the Glen Jackson Bridge, and we have a number of other bridges that cross between the two states. So the states know how to work together and cooperate to build and maintain bridges. And we look at this one as an opportunity to not only reduce congestion, but importantly improve safety, and not only safety on the roadway, but also safety for the water traffic that has to weave its way between the railroad bridge directly downstream and the Columbia River bridge at I-5. So with that as a context, we're working together with Washington that this is not a one-off project. It's part of a longer, larger strategy. I'll turn it over to Mr. Osborne to walk you through what this project is and what the benefits will be. John?
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, committee members. I'm John Osborne. I'm your project director on the Columbia River Crossing Project. On the first slide, just gives us a little bit of contrast. In March of 1965, that's what the facilities looked like and what the skyline of the city of Vancouver looked like. And then that's contrasted with today. You can see that we built right up next to the I-5 corridor. And the complexion of downtown Vancouver has also changed. What is the Columbia River Crossing Project? It is a five-mile project that essentially is a bridge, a highway, and a transit project whereby we reconstruct 5 miles of I-5 between SR 500 in Vancouver and Columbia Boulevard in Portland. It includes the total reconstruction of 6 interchanges and the introduction of a high-capacity transit system in the area. It does connect with 4 state highways, 5 major arterials, and provides access to 2 deep water ports, the Port of Portland, international ports, the Port of Portland and the ports of Vancouver. The Columbia River bridges really are quite vital to the freight movement of the region. On the next slide, we can see what I like to refer to as an angiogram. You can see that I-5 and I-84 are absolutely vital to the freight movement of Oregon and Washington. And this project is right in the middle of it at the confluence. Today, 67% of all the freight in the region currently ships by truck, and that's expected to grow to about 73% by 2030. And freight volume is expected to double over that time period. This corridor also serves an average of 48 trains a day, freight trains, and 12 passenger trains, and over 100 trains a day are expected to move through this corridor by 2025. The next slide shows where this project lies. From a regional perspective, we can see that we have the Port of Vancouver, the Port of Portland that are adjacent to this project. We have the Portland International Airport, which is also important to freight movement. This particular region is a confluence of two navigable rivers. It's a connection of two major railroads, and we have two major interstates that come together right here in this region. The bridge influence area really is at the center of the freight hub for Washington and Oregon. If we take a look on an average afternoon, we can see that the bridge influence area has some of the worst congestion in the region. Typically northbound in the afternoon, 15 miles an hour or less is what folks would travel northbound. Similarly, in the morning, traffic is backed up from SR 500 in Vancouver down through Delta Park. So why do we need this project? The safety issues do continue to grow in the region. Currently, we experience about twice the accidents of what we would normally see on an urban facility. And at the bridgehead on the north side of Vancouver, we experience about four times what we would normally expect to see in urban facilities. Part of that's due to bridge lifts. The congestion that we have from the population and the economic growth is expected to increase. Currently, we have congestion in the region for about 5 hours a day. That's projected to go to about 11 hours a day if we don't do anything. In addition to that, we don't have the best bike and pedestrian facilities. This project would look to improve some of those. And the freight mobility certainly gets caught up in the congestion that we experience every day. One of the other challenges that we face in the region is the river navigation. Currently, in order for barges to get underneath the high span of the bridge and not use the lift span, they have to make what the barge captains call the S maneuver, and that's to line up with the railroad bridge to the south and the swing span that's in that. This is touted as one of the worst or most challenging river navigation features on the Columbia River. So how have we engaged the public with this particular process? I would like to say that really our public engagement with this process, with this project, has been unprecedented. We've talked with over 10,000 people and been to over 350 events just since March of 2006. We're in about our third year of the process. We have a 39-member task force that's composed of a very wide cross-section of stakeholders, from neighborhoods to business groups to environmental folks, the ports, and other folks that are stakeholders with the project. We also have advisory groups that are helping us with community environmental justice issues. We have a freight working group. We also have a bicycle and pedestrian working group. So what's the process that we've followed, and what are the key milestones in the process? We did work with our task force and with the public for a number of months to identify exactly what the problems were that we were going to solve with this particular project. We set the vision for the corridor, and we set evaluation criteria that would be the yardstick, if you will, that we would use to evaluate ideas as they came in. We then assembled a wide array of potential solutions for the project, both for highway and for transit components. And then we screened those ideas based on the yardstick that we were given. We developed alternatives. Out of the 12 alternatives that we started with, that really was on one side of the spectrum, very focused on transit and very little improvement to highways, to the other side, very little for transit and a great deal for highways. We settled on five of the most promising alternatives with the help of our stakeholders. We took those into a detailed evaluation process. The results of that we are about to publish in the draft environmental impact statement. We expect to come out with that document the first part of next month for public comment and feedback on that. Once we receive feedback from the public and from the stakeholders in the project, we hope to develop a locally preferred alternative, which is the political solution that we, or the project solution that we have consensus both politically and technically for the project, and we would be working that and getting board approvals through the June and July timeframe of this year. From there on, we hope to have project approval and a record of decision from the USDOT by late 2009, and then with funding available, we would hope to be able to start final design, right-of-way acquisition, and construction in the 2009 to 2011 period. So currently in the DEIS, to get to a locally preferred alternative, we're looking at making three key choices. The first being, what type of bridge do we build? Is it a replacement bridge, or do we keep the existing bridges and try to supplement them in some way? The second being, what is the transit mode? Would it be a bus rapid transit system, or would it be a light rail system, which is the most efficient for the region? And the third being the transit alignment. Would it be along I-5 in Vancouver or up through downtown? Would it be west of I-5 or adjacent to I-5 in the Hayden Island area? So aside from the replacement and the supplemental options for the bridge components and for the bus rapid transit or for the light rail for the transit components, some other things that we did look at was does a tunnel make sense? Does a new corridor crossing to the east or the west solve the problems on I-5? Should we make improvements on I-205 as well? Should we do a streetcar, or how about if we use commuter rail or heavy rail for the transit component? Those are all things that we've considered and evaluated not to be promising ideas. So what issues are addressed in the draft EIS? We've taken a look at how the different five alternatives that we've carried forward, which is a replacement or a supplemental option, each paired with a bus rapid transit or light rail option, and of course a no build, what happens if we do nothing. So once we get the decision on the bridge and the mode type, we will continue to work with the public about what does a transit station look like and where are they located, how can we best make bicycle and pedestrian improvements to hook into trails and things that are planned in regional plans, and what should the bridge look like and where should it be aligned specifically. Very quickly, a replacement bridge option would look something similar to what you have on page 14, slide 14. It's essentially building the bridge downstream of the existing bridges, and then we would cut traffic over to the new facilities and take out the existing structures. There's several advantages to this in that it does remove the lift span. It does allow us to bring the system up to standard. It does have much better navigational features to it, and it does give us some flexibility in bridge type. And the supplemental option essentially would be an option where we kept the existing bridges for northbound traffic, and then we would build a new facility that would be high enough not to have a lift span that would include a high-capacity transit component as well as the southbound traffic. The bicycle and pedestrian facilities would be included on the existing facilities. In short, based on the criteria that we have, the supplemental bridge option does perform a little bit better in that it's slightly less expensive and it has a little bit less impact to the historic aspect, since one of the bridges is historic. But in all of the other components, the replacement bridge is a much better solution in terms of congestion management, in terms of safety for the and reliability of the system. Speaking of safety, the replacement bridge does allow us to address almost all of the non-standard features on the system. It does remove the lift spans and has much less congestion than what a supplemental bridge would. The supplemental bridge only allows us to address some of the features, and it actually adds new mainline merge and diverge sections in that, which we question how that improves safety in some respects. So the key findings, essentially, the replacement bridge does have considerably less congestion with it than what we would have over today, and much better local circulation, as well as being able to address the seismic and the navigational issues. With regards to high-capacity transit, we are currently looking at bus rapid transit and at light rail. Essentially, the bus rapid transit would carry approximately 91 folks per trip. It would be on dedicated lanes across the bridge and outside of that with other traffic in other locations. The light rail would be an extension of the Yellow Line into Vancouver, essentially. A light rail does carry up to 266 folks per trip. With regards to the amount of folks that we can move on transit, currently our projections are with no build out in the year 2030, we would have approximately 2.5 million people that would use public transit. With bus rapid transit and a replacement, we would be looking at 4.8 million shifting to transit. And with a light rail and a replacement option, that number would be 6.7 million. We also looked at options with a supplemental of what would happen if we greatly increased transit services in Vancouver. And the short of it is that we could increase transit networks and availability in Vancouver by about 40%, and it would only result in about 10% additional river crossings. So there's a call for transit in Vancouver, but it doesn't really amount to by a great increase there to a lot more folks actually getting off I-5 and using transit across the bridge. The key findings with regards to transit is that bus rapid transit does have slightly lower capital costs, but it does have higher operating costs. Light rail does have higher capital costs, but it has significantly lower operating costs. And light rail does have higher ridership. So essentially, the cost per rider is about 25% less for a light rail solution than it is for a bus rapid transit solution. The project will improve mobility in the region. Currently, we have 4 hours of congestion in the region. This is northbound. If we do nothing and the no-build congestion, we see that almost doubling to about 8 hours a day. And we still don't move many folks by transit. With the replacement bridge, we're looking at approximately 2 hours of congestion in 2030, which is about half of what we have today. But we have a significant increase, not only in the folks that were able to move across the river on I-5, but also with the transit component as well. The supplemental bridge option does result in significant congestion. That's what I alluded to earlier, is essentially we wind up with about 7 hours of congestion still with the replacement option. So it really doesn't fix the congestion issue as well as what we had hoped. One of the things that I did want to point out was that if we take a look at the I-5 bridge, under no-build conditions, we expect approximately 184,000 trips a day by the year 2030. Currently, there's 134,000 trips a day. And we recognize that the solution to this project really does need to be comprehensive, and we do need to provide folks with options, and livability is important to folks. So with the addition of a high-capacity transit line, we're looking at peak hour to move from about 5 to 20% of the folks moving in the corridor onto transit during the 4 hours of the peak commute. And with the introduction of tolls, it really does have folks think about the choices that they make around transportation. And we expect that there will actually be, with the project, less cars moving into downtown Portland than what there would be under a no-build scenario. So we expect that to be about 178,000 a day under a replacement option, and about 165,000 a day if we went with a supplemental option. So cost for the project. Currently, we have five alternatives that are on the table, so there's a little bit of a spread between those. Our preliminary cost estimate runs from $3.1 to $4.2 billion, and that's in year of expenditure. Essentially, the bridge cost, whether a replacement option, runs about $2.9 to $3 billion for the highway and the bridge itself, and a supplemental option would be slightly less, about $2.7 to $2.8 billion. With regards to high-capacity transit, depending on where the line ended and the mode that was used, that would run anywhere from about $520 million to $1.2 billion. So how would we pay for that? Currently, we would have two states. We're looking at having two states contribute a portion of it. Tolling would contribute a significant portion of the funding for the project. Federal highway discretionary funds would also be a component that we would be looking at coming into the project. And then the Federal Transit Administration has a New Starts program, which we would be looking also for a considerable share of the funds to be coming from for that. So really, what are some of the project benefits? By building the project, we do provide the public with a safer and more reliable transportation system. We do reduce congestion and improve mobility of the system. We give commuters real choices around transit. We have predictable times for not only freight movement, but for those folks that need to make a commute to work as well, and improve the freight mobility in the region. But the bottom line is that really we're able to support the economies of two states, and we're able to improve the livability of our communities. So thank you, and if you have any questions, I would be glad to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Osborne. Senator Monroe.
Yes, one point that I thought you kind of missed was when you were comparing bus rapid transit to light rail. By the way, for those of you that don't know this, I've been working on this project for over 10 years as well. I was the Metro representative to the Regional Transportation Commission and also was the head of JPAC most of the time during the early stages of this, so it's not new to me. The point is this. I think studies show that if you use bus rapid transit and then connect to the light rail at Expo or somewhere in there, the people have to do a transfer, and they're much less likely to use transit than if they get a seamless ride all the way from Vancouver to Hillsboro or to Gresham or to downtown Portland or to Clackamas Town Center or wherever they're going. It seems to me that is an important point. I've heard Mayor Pollard say that they would be stupid not to connect to this multi-billion-dollar light rail system that Oregon has already built. Can you comment?
Chair Metzger, Senator Monroe, you are absolutely correct in that the transfer time, in addition to adding approximately 5 minutes at best to the trip, does reflect in the ridership numbers, and it was buried within that 25% cost per rider, because we do expect more riders with a light rail system. It is more attractive for folks not to have to make the transfer, and Mayor Pollard has been quite supportive of a light rail solution, to say the least. And quite frankly, that's our recommendation, and all of the data points to a light rail solution being a more efficient solution and one that folks actually would use, cleaner as well.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. The other issue is, of course, tolling. Everybody's assuming that we'll need to toll this bridge. I remember when the current bridge was tolled, it was 20 cents. We had to throw two dimes in the hopper when we went across it. The toll came off when the bonds were paid, and I have two questions with respect to tolling. One is, would you plan that the toll would end when the project is paid for in 20 or 30 years? And secondly, would you also toll the I-205 bridge?
Chair Metzger, Senator Monroe.
Easy questions.
They are easy because we don't know the answers exactly yet. We do know that when a bridge is paid off, the costs don't end. and that there are ongoing costs for maintenance and operations. And I think as we have the opportunity to have the broader discussion about transportation funding, that issue about do you remove the tolls immediately when bonds are paid off, or do you continue to cover the cost of maintenance operations is definitely a question that we need to address in the transportation funding package. With respect to the I-205 bridge, we are looking at, we've not ruled that out in terms of tolling that bridge. There are some procedural issues that we would have to go through with the Federal Highway Administration. Not sure exactly how that would come out. But as we move forward and present options for financial plans on this structure, that will be part of the plan that you'll see, is what would happen if you tolled both bridges versus what happens if you tolled one. I think that this project is so large that we have to keep all of those options on the table, and we have to look at all of those things as the decision makers figure out, you know, there's a big lift here in terms of how are we going to pay for this and what are our options. And I think we have to deliver that to you, and we will.
And a couple others. Just the last numbers I saw showed that some 70,000 approximately people commute from Washington and work in Oregon, and approximately 20,000 commute from Oregon and work in Washington, something like that. Have you projected what those numbers will be like in 2020 or 2030?
Go ahead. Chair Metzger, Senator Monroe. Currently, there's approximately 65,000 folks that live in Vancouver and work in Oregon. There's approximately 12,000 folks that live in Oregon and work in Vancouver. I think that by the 2030 sort of time frame, we will start to see those numbers come a little bit more into balance, but exactly what those numbers are, I don't know exactly.
Thank you.
Senator,
Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Monroe asked some of the questions that I had in my mind. I would discourage the broad look at tolling as the source of funding, and I know that the task force is. What I know is that the use of tolls and variable tolls can do more than just collect money, but can help to manage the traffic flows. Technologies is pretty exciting, and the ability to have people driving at 60 miles an hour, free-flowing traffic, that would require, quite honestly, to toll both bridges, I think, to make that system probably work at its optimum. So I really don't have anything else to add other than to state maybe the obvious is that Clark County, I believe, has had at least a couple of opportunities to voice their opinion on light rail and has voted against extending the light rail into Clark County. You know, Mayor Pollard's perspective aside, do you have any ideas that the attitudes and the voters' perspectives of light rail has changed over the last 3, 4, 5, half dozen years?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, at the last task force meeting, they took a straw poll, if you will, that kind of went around the room of representatives from both sides of the river. And I guess I haven't seen any polling that would indicate this, but certainly that, as you go around the task force, every person there said that it appeared that a replacement bridge with light rail was probably where we were headed, just in terms of the cost and the benefits that you get out of it. And so that was both sides of the river, including Clark County commissioners, or a Clark County commissioner that was that said that. So I think that my perception would have been a couple of years ago that they were adamantly against it, and apparently there's been some softening, at least in some portions of the county.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. The idea of tolling vehicles and trucks that use the new bridge to fund light rail, how is that split going to occur? Where's the light rail money going to come from? Looks like the light rail is another over $1 billion in addition to just building a bridge that moves traffic and deals with the congestion issues on the highway side. Are you going to have the car driving folks subsidize the light rail construction?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, with the restrictions in Article 9, Section 3A of the Oregon Constitution, we would not be able to do that because a toll on vehicular traffic would have to be used for highways. The presumption of the funding for the transit portion is largely what's called the New Starts program. It's a federal program, and that's where we're looking for that money to come from. As we refine the financial models, I will make sure that we call that out specifically so that you can see exactly where that funding's coming from.
And since Mr. Chair, you brought up the New Starts, isn't it true that the federal transit program is changed course, should we say, and that you know, the president's budget has borrowed, quite honestly, from the transit budget to put money into the highway budget. And from my what I'm hearing or reading from what's happening at the federal level, the New Starts program is being trimmed back significantly. Do you honestly believe you're going to get $1 billion out of the federal government for a New Starts program for a light rail line over the Columbia River?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I'm not honestly believe it. I did until you just told me that, because I hadn't heard that before. But I don't know what the situation is in terms of the New Starts funding, given what you just said, and we will pursue that with FTA. I don't that's news to me.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to talk a little bit about process on this. Obviously, I think probably all of us on this committee got some feedback, maybe the people who didn't get their way or whatever, but I'm very interested in the process. On your slide 10, you talk about the selective alternatives, which there was the feedback that's coming back, at least that we're getting from citizens who seem to be very active on this issue, is that the options that were available did not include what a lot of the public thought there would be, which is a third bridge on those options. Can you explain a little bit about the process outside of the replacement bridge or the I-5 corridor, as far as what was the process that you folks went through to look at other options other than the I-5 corridor? A third bridge, in essence, is what we're talking about.
Certainly. Chair Metzger, Senator George. We spent a lot of time working with our task force and the public to first identify what the problem was that we would be solving, and it has several components to it. And in addition to that, what the evaluation criteria that we would be using to evaluate ideas as they came in. And the primary things that we set out to do were to fix the safety issues in the I-5 corridor, to fix the congestion and the freight mobility issues that we had in the I-5 corridor, to address the seismic issues that we had, and to give folks choices for transit and to make sure that we had better bicycle and pedestrian connections all in the I-5 corridor. This project came out of the I-5 Transportation and Trade Partnership Study, and as Mr. Tindall had indicated earlier, this is the third project that is a result of that. We did look extensively at third bridge alternatives, and I don't have the data here to show you, but I can tell you that approximately 70% of the folks that move through this area either get on I-5, get off I-5, or do both within this 5-mile section. The folks that use this, the 135,000 folks a day that use it, want to be in I-5. We took a look at what would happen with arterial connections or other bridges, and essentially what happens is that approximately 10% of the folks that are currently using the I-5 corridor would shift to a different corridor. So that doesn't address the congestion problems on I-5 and the mobility issues that we face there. And it also doesn't give us the opportunities to make the safety improvements in the corridor or to add the high-capacity transit in the corridor to help relieve the I-5 congestion, which the transit component actually helps us to get folks off of I-5 so that we can have a better, more efficient system there. So to answer your question in short is that a crossing someplace else does not solve the problems that we're looking to address in I-5.
And Chair Starr, Senator George, I'd just add that on page 12, there's a more complete listing of all of those things that were looked at, including the new Western Highway, including improvements to I-205, the arterial crossings that John just mentioned. So we looked across a fairly broad west to east scenario of places that we could possibly expand capacity for the Columbia River crossing.
If I can, Mr. Chairman. So I guess the gripe that's been brought up to the committee has been is that this has been a light rail driven process. So I appreciate that background. So let's move to light rail a little bit. I want to understand exactly a little bit about how we focus on light rail. As I understand it, looking at your numbers, the maximum number of people that a light rail line could get across the bridge in any 1 hour would be somewhere around 2,200 to 2,500 people per hour, assuming 8 to 10 trains per hour at the 266 people per car that you gave. So your once you built that corridor, your maximum capacity would be somewhere in the neighborhood of less than 2,500 per hour, so at peak hours. As I understand, a bus corridor, these studies that have been done on exclusive bus corridors have showed that the same amount of space can move up to 40,000 persons per hour, because you can put more buses across, more seats across the same square footage as you could in trains for seats per train. So your differential is that at maximum capacity, absolute maximum capacity, light rail can move 2,500 individuals across the river within any one given hour, where a bus system could move considerably higher number because of the fact that you can get more buses across the river than you could light rail trains. And I was just wondering how those issues factored into your decision making. Your models that you've given us here are all built on a maximum capacity of 2,500 people moving across rail in any one given hour, and I'm trying to balance why the maximum capacity on buses wouldn't have been factored into that model.
Chair Starr, Senator Metzger, I'll let John give you the detailed answer. Although the 266 people that you're citing is for a two-car train, and I think generally they run six or eight-car trains. So actually, if you're running, for instance, an eight-car train, it's four times that many people. Again, at the headways you were talking about at 10 an hour or 8 an hour, the number's higher than 2,500 just by the numbers that we have here. But I'll let John...
Real quickly, if I could. Doug, that's actually not, as I understand it, are you going to then run a train from Vancouver, not cross, and then drop into the yellow line in the north, and then have those people transfer onto the rail, to a different light rail system? So if you're not, then you're limited to a two-car train all through North Portland. Just because of limitations on interstate, so you're limited to two-car trains.
Yes, I see your point.
Chair Starr, Vice Chair Starr, and Senator George, we can increase the frequency of the trains in North Portland to be able to increase the capacity of light rail. I'm not sure where the figures came, but the indications that the transit folks have been giving me is that light rail does actually have more capacity in the system than what a bus rapid transit system does. Additionally, the impacts onto downtown traffic is such that with the lesser number of trains, we can preempt signals and have better efficiencies. The kind of volume that you would be talking about with buses is that there would be a bus coming and going about every minute and a half. And it basically destroys downtown traffic, so that there's also trade-offs with that. So I think the telling tale is if you look on slide number 19, what we're showing is that with bus rapid transit, in a year's time, we can move about 4.8 million people, and we can move about 6.7 million with a light rail transit option. And I know that we looked at, on the bus rapid transit, having headways about every minute and a half we had a bus coming in.
Mr. Chairman, if I could. This is actually the issue. This actually slide on slide 19 is actually what, based on everything I've ever read, I don't understand how these numbers were calculated. If you do 25, if you give a maximum of 2,500 passengers per hour, maximum, And if you just said 3 hours in the rush hour on both ends where the trains are actually full, if I do my math correctly, you're at under 3 million total ridership both ways. And I'm trying to figure out where these numbers came from as far as I'm not quite understanding. And then the second of all, the system of the idea of a bus rapid transit system is that they're not all going from point A to point B. It would give you flexibility. Your bottleneck is going over the river. That's where your bottleneck is. And so the idea is getting more people into transit and going to different locations. And what buses do is they give you that flexibility. And I'm just wondering if outside of the narrow area we're looking at, when you look at the buses, they may want to go to a number of different job centers, a number of areas where we have job centers. The question is it seems like a bus system, you would move a lot more people across that bridge, and you could provide almost door-to-door service with a bus system. I'm just trying to make sure that this isn't, I mean, the complaint that's being brought up is that this is a light rail-driven system, a light rail-driven process. And I just want to make sure that if we're going to approve this, that we're looking at the transit systems in apples to apples. And if you could kind of discuss that, generally, I don't understand how you could come up with an idea that light rail would actually move more people than buses, because I've never seen one study that actually showed, just because you're limited to the maximum of 10 trains per hour, and typically they've never been able to get past 8 per hour across any one set of tracks. And I would just have that discussion. I'd appreciate it.
Chair Starr, Senator George, again, we don't have those numbers here, and I certainly can understand your questions. And so what I propose is that we deliver to the committee the specific calculations that were used to generate those numbers. And I think we need to get down to the details, and then if you've got questions on the assumptions, certainly we're glad to talk about why we made the assumptions that we made. But I think we need the actual, I mean, we didn't just make these up. They came from a calculation, and I think we need to walk through that calculation and make sure that we're on the same page and indeed comparing apples to apples. I can tell you from just the oversight of the project, we feel like we are. But obviously, we can't answer your questions right now, so we owe you that answer.
One more follow up, Mr. Chair. I guess the question that Senator Starr brought up is my next big concern. We go forward with a project that has light rail component attached to it. And what if there is, so we start going forward, and then all of a sudden there isn't federal money to build the light rail portion of it. Are you guys making this so there's a severability available in there in the project, so that if light rail is not funded at the federal level, that those dollars, that project can be go forward without the light rail funding from the federal government? Or are we looking at the backup plan is we don't get the federal funding, this comes back onto the taxpayers of the state of Oregon and the state of Washington?
Chair Metzger, Senator George. There are components of the system that are highway alone that we would be able to move forward with, but I think the question that we would have to answer is to the community at large. What we have proposed to move forward with is a comprehensive solution to the project, which includes a high-capacity transit component as well as highway improvements. And I can't speak for what the public would tell me, but I have a high degree of suspicion that if we propose to move forward with a highway component only, if we didn't get funding, there would be challenges in maintaining political support for the project without a transit component. Technically, if we had the funding, could we move forward with highway components of the project without transit? Yes. But there is the other aspect that we would have to address as well.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment to finalize. I guess that's sort of my point is that I think that we need, would make me much more comfortable is if the project was actually in stages, which is if we got highway dollars, we build the highway portion of it. If we've got transit dollars, we have a transit portion of it, and I'm more than willing to go down that path. But I'm a little nervous about the exact statement, which is there's a political component to this, which is we're tying a specific transit alternative to the whole project, and that if that transit alternative doesn't come forward, that the whole project goes down. And for those of us who are in the freight business who need to move stuff north and south, I don't want to be held politically hostage by a transit portion and see the entire project go down because of the political ramifications of a specific transit alternative. And that's, I really have a grave concern about this because of the fact that, those of us who are in manufacturing and those types of things and all of our business people need to have a road that can move freight north and south more than anything. So that'd be my comment. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate it.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I believe that those options, those phasing options, will be in the finance plan as we lay that out. So
I would really appreciate it.
The finance plan is going to be a key. It's some of the questions we can't answer. Technically, it's always possible to build something without all of the components to it. Except, you know, sometimes you can end up with just the middle of the bridge with no approaches, which is somewhat non-useful. But you can always build something. And as we lay those things out, I think that's where I'm looking for that to become clear is in the financial options and how we move forward and how quickly we move forward on both the bridge portion, the transit portion, and the interchange portions that are also part of this project.
Okay, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. And I apologize for being out of the room. This may have come up, and if it has, stop me. I was saying goodbye to a Turkish Rotary Exchange student. I don't know if anybody's asked about the accommodation for the bicycles and the pedestrians.
Yeah.
Did that come up? Okay.
Would you like to hear? I mean, we covered it.
Then I won't hoe that row again. I guess only just to add the comment that my view of this bridge has been just what Senator George articulated, that we got to move freight. And I don't know how much additional cost the bikes and the peds add, but at some point, isn't it conceivable that they would ride across the bridge on whatever kind of transit option is offered rather than building separate accommodation that just drives the cost of this already unbelievably expensive structure up?
Senator Metzger, or Chair Metzger, Senator Johnson, we do have included in our plans now a joint use facility. I guess it is possible that folks could make connections to a high capacity transit connection that does go across the bridge at, say, Hayden Island, which would be one stop, and then the first stop in Vancouver, I guess, that went over to the other side. Certainly the community would expect to be able to walk along the bridge as they can do today. And I'm not sure that a reasonably sized facility would add a huge amount to the project, although I think somewhere in the neighborhood of about $30 million is what we're looking at for bicycle and pedestrian facility to get across the river. And that is a lot of money.
It's a jaw-dropping amount of money.
Yes. But the bridge itself would be about $1.2 billion to get across. So in percentage-wise, which we do have certain obligations to spend a certain amount for bicycle and pedestrian use, it's in the realm of what we would expect to spend.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Why do we have that obligation?
Chair Metzger, Senator Johnson, it's an Oregon statute that requires 1% to be spent, 1% of the money in the highway fund to be spent on bicycles every year. Bicycle and pedestrian projects every year.
Yeah.
Senator Starr wants to make a comment on that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true in statute, but it doesn't require every project to have 1%. You can spend that 1% anywhere in the state. You don't have to spend it on this project. And $30 million buys me a new interchange in Washington County that we desperately need to move people safely.
Fixes Cornelius Pass Road, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
There's tons of places.
Chair Master, Senator Starr, you're absolutely correct. The question about it is 1% of the total, not 1% of every project. That's exactly right.
Any other questions? Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to ask several questions just to expedite this process. Mine are very simple. Thank you for the handout so that it is really probably one of the first times I've given this much thought to this particular project. Number one, I just want to know, when you have tolling, do you have to have an alternative route? That would be my first question. The next one is the bridge design. You show in the downstream replacement bridge, which is quite a curve, and then you show in the other supplemental bridge, and you only refer to congestion. And because of the Minneapolis thing, I think most people are looking at safety. So if you would address that, if they're both equally as safe, however, this curve bridge makes me wonder. Also, have you thought about the evacuation route, if you, on this particular bridge, if you turn both bridges going either north or south, whichever state is affected by a disaster, the kind of accommodation that you would one or the other be more beneficial? And have you looked at cities like Houston, Texas, and Las Vegas that are doing quite large projects very similar that you can compare?
Okay, let me take the first one, the last one, and I'll let John deal with the alignment and safety issues. On tolling, I don't believe that there's any statutory requirement or a federal rule requirement that requires a free alternative. So obviously there are free alternatives that are just a long ways away, but I'm not aware of anything that requires a free alternative within a certain distance. In terms of the evacuation issue, it's less of a problem in terms of a particular bridge and more of a problem in terms of the ramps at interchanges. If I have to flip a highway, to turn a highway so it's all going one direction, I've got to figure out how to close off the ramps to keep people from coming down the wrong way, firstly, and secondly, I've got to figure out how to get them back out of one direction at some point. I haven't looked at this section of highway extensively. I looked at the evacuation out of downtown Portland going southbound, and there's some ideas about how to do it, but it's very difficult to get the traffic back over into their appropriate lanes, and so you can get emergency services in. And that's the challenge when you turn a highway to one direction, is it's going one direction and it's going full one direction. And if you need to move emergency services into the area, you got to have some alternate route to do that. So that's less of a bridge question and more of an interchange and downstream question. John, you want to talk about the alignment and safety?
Chair Metzger, Senator Berger. With regards to the supplemental and the downstream replacement bridge, the downstream replacement bridge does allow us to make the system much safer. We are able to put standard shoulders into the system. We're able to address the horizontal and vertical curvature issues so that the line of sight is safer for folks to use. And actually, the broader curve that you see allows us to eliminate shorter curves up in the Vancouver side and to minimize the footprint both on Hayden Island as well as on the Vancouver. So the replacement bridge structure downstream has a potential to be much safer than what the supplemental option would be. In addition, the replacement bridge does remove the bridge lifts, which stops traffic and results in safety issues for the system.
Okay, one last question from Senator Monroe, and then we're going to go on to our next.
Yeah, just to respond to a couple of items. First of all, I attended a lot of hearings in North and Northeast Portland, and there were people who were very, very skeptical about expanding I-5 and funneling more congested cars and trucks. The level of asthma and other respiratory diseases along I-5, the Minnesota Freeway, are already elevated, and there was considerable opposition. The only thing that buys them off is if we convince them that a lot of those people are going to be getting out of their cars and getting on the train, which moves a lot faster, has a lot of advantages. Many people will ride a light rail that will not ride on a bus. It's just a fact. We saw that when we put in the first MAX lines. The vote that was taken in Vancouver that was negative was more than a decade ago, and it was heavily negative in the battleground and the outer parts of the county, pretty close in the actual city of Vancouver. And, of course, public opinion has changed since then. The yellow line has been built since then. A lot of things are changing. Our goal, the goal of all of us, is we have to move freight more effectively. Believe me, freight isn't moving very effectively in that corridor now. You're just sitting there at 10 miles an hour, 5 miles an hour, for hours and hours and hours on end. Putting 65, or a big portion of those 65,000 people on MAX, and building a bigger bridge will allow that freight traffic to move much more freely. and will ultimately reduce the amount of air pollution in that corridor as well. So it's, you know, it's really going to be a win-win. It does cost a lot of money, and the federal New Starts program is under attack. Senator Starr was absolutely right. But you know what? Next January, we're going to have a new administration, and it may very well have a new attitude about transit. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for updating us on this issue.
McCain,
we're going to close the informational hearing on the Columbia River Crossing and open an informational hearing on the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act as it impacts transportation. I've asked for this hearing today and asked that Ralph Saperstein and Jim Geisinger and Dave Barrels come forward. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair, for holding this informational session. It's
absolutely
very important. I'm Ralph Saperstein. I work with Conklin, Fiskman, McCormick, and today I'm representing Friends of the Elliott, Boise Cascade, and Douglas Timber Operators. With me, Jim Geisinger and Dave Barrels. And I thought the best thing to do, because I have such learned historical men with me, that I would go first and they could clean up all my mess. We're here, we asked for this because of some misconceptions about county payments and broken promises. And they came on the House side when a hearing was held in the Rural Policy Committee on HJM 100, which is the memorial that I think is now in the Senate.
Yeah, we passed that out of Senate Education General Government yesterday.
Okay, so it'll come to the floor then. It's a memorial to Congress that expresses support for all rural Oregonians and urges support for reauthorization and extension of Secure Rural Schools and County Self-Determination Act of year 2000, otherwise known as county payments. The misperception that stirred me to ask for this information session was the claim that cutting off payments to the counties by the federal government was a broken promise. The halting of county payments is not the real broken promise. The real broken promise is the more than 90% reduction in timber supply from our federal forest lands. The promise, the one that was really broken, originated with the Organic Act of 1897 for the National Forest and the ONC Act, Lands Act of 1937 for BLM lands. And Dave Barrels was in Washington, D.C. lobbying that act when it passed.
Mr. Chair, point of clarification,
yes,
is that the 1897 act that he was lobbying or the subsequent act?
I was 2 years old then, and I couldn't do that. But I was ready for the 37 act.
I'm glad I got you between us. Both of these acts promised a sustained yield of timber from federal forest lands. This is the promise that has been broken. Those laws encourage people to build sawmills and communities throughout rural Oregon based on the promise of a sustained yield of timber in perpetuity. Rural Oregon was built on the backs of the public timber-dependent timber industry. And the counties enjoyed the timber receipts from timber sales from our federal forest lands. Those receipts were for roads, schools, and general purpose funds for the counties. My career offers just one example that was duplicated hundreds of times throughout Oregon. After leaving college, I went to work for the state of Oregon on the Elliott State Forest. 30 years ago, the Elliott was one of the best examples of a sustainably managed working forest producing significant contributions to the economies of Coos Bay, Coquille, Reedsport, Roseburg, and Riddle. But that's another story for another hearing, hopefully at the State Land Board. A private timber company in Roseburg hired me from the Elliott. The company began when a man left Nazi Germany in the 1930s for a better life in the United States. He founded the company in the 40s, but before he settled in Texas, and he developed a flour mill and then heard of the stained deal of timber that was available in Oregon. And so he left Texas and came to Roseburg and built his sawmill. His company, Sun Studs Incorporated, developed the first computerized sawmill in the early 1970s. Most sawmills in the Pacific Northwest used the technology he developed, either legally or illegally. Fortunately, Fred Sohn plowed his profits into the purchase of cut-over forest land on the South Coast. When federal timber supply stopped in the 1990s, Sun Studs was sold, and Fred's legacy is now purely a timberland-owning company in Roseburg. This story can be repeated, or was repeated, throughout Oregon. In Eugene, Medford, LeGrand, Hood River, Sweet Home, Oak Ridge, Coos Bay, Coquille, Mapleton, and lots more of towns that were built up on the public timber industry. These communities were home to public timber-dependent companies that were built on the promise of a sustained yield of timber from some of the world's most productive forest land. Today, according to the state forester yesterday in the House, he said that 13 million out of the 16 million acres of federal forest land in Oregon are in a hazardous state they're vulnerable to catastrophic wildfire due to the unnatural conditions that were created from the lack of management on those forests in the past decade and a half. That is the broken promise. Rural Oregon was built on sustainably managed federal forests. Besides losing the public dependent timber supply, the fire hazards caused by these forests right now threaten the whole communities. So it's really, first they hit them economically, and now because rural Oregon is in juxtaposition with these federal forest lands that are high hazard for catastrophic wildfire, they're now threatening the communities themselves after they took away the jobs. So I'd be glad to answer any questions, but I think
we'll go through with the three of you, and then
because I said they're more learned, so that's why you want to hear them.
Okay.
We're ready for the learned now.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jim Geisinger with Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade association representing slightly over 1,000 contract loggers and businesses associated with the logging industry. You kind of have a lineup here in reverse order of seniority, and earlier in my career I had the foresight to hire Ralph Saperstein for a couple of jobs. Earlier in my career before that, Mr. Barrows was one of my mentors, so I'll have to take some responsibility for Ralph. He'll have to take some responsibility for me. But almost 60% of the forest lands in Oregon are owned by the federal government, almost 16 million acres. And frankly, in the 30 years I've been involved in this business, the state of Oregon has not taken a very active role in trying to affect how those lands are managed, and yet it represents the majority of our forest lands. For about four decades, starting in the 50s, going right up to the late 1980s, about half of the timber harvested in Oregon came from these lands. The harvest levels in that four decades averaged about 8 to 8.5 billion board feet, with about half coming from our federal lands. But to put things into perspective, the federal lands are growing then and growing today in excess of 11 billion board feet of timber. So even at the highest harvest levels in this state's history from our federal lands, about half the growth was being harvested. Today, about 3% of the growth is being harvested. On the Forest Service lands, the counties that traditionally received 25% of those revenues. By statute, 75% of those funds went to maintaining roads, and 25% went to schools. So this issue does have relevance to your committee. On the BLM lands, I'm sure Mr. Barrows will get in more detail on this, 75% of the timber revenues went to the counties. The counties agreed to plow back 25% of those funds and back into the land to maintain the productivity. Today, by statute, they can receive 50% of the proceeds. Ralph kind of brought us up to the point in our history where things began to change dramatically on federal land management. In the 1970s, Congress passed a number of laws that had a profound influence on the future management of those lands. Probably the one that's had the greatest impact, and I'll discuss it in a little more detail later, was the National Environmental Policy Act, passed in the early 70s. It appeared at the time to be a very well-intentioned, rational law. All it required is that the federal government disclose the economic and environmental consequences of major federal actions. That sounds like a pretty reasonable thing to do. Later in the decade, in 1976, Congress passed the National Forest Management Act and the Federal Land Policy Management Act, FLIPMA. NFMA provided the template for the future management of the national forest. FLIPMA provided a similar template for lands managed by the Department of Interior. And like a lot of laws that are passed by Congress, they seem well-intended and simple at the time, but then they go through an evolutionary process. First, the land management agencies develop regulations interpreting what they thought Congress meant those laws to be. And then, subsequent to that, we've had three decades of litigation where the courts of our country have decided what they think those laws meant. NEPA in particular has been interpreted and reinterpreted and interpreted again by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, resulting in a situation today where I truly believe that neither of those agencies can write an environmental impact statement that can pass muster in a court of law, and particularly here in the Ninth Circuit. We have very activist judges who read the newspapers, who think they know what public sentiment is about some of these issues, and they interpret NEPA in a way that I think the drafters of the legislation would find absolutely counterproductive and counter to what they intended when they drafted that law. So NFMA launched a new round of forest management plans that resulted in new management plans for the National Forest in Oregon in the mid to late 80s. That was about the time that the spotted owl raised its head as a potentially threatened species. One of the things the National Forest Management Act required the region to do is develop a regional guide providing specific guidelines to individual national forests as to how their plan should be developed. And some of those guidelines dealt with how the spotted owl should be accommodated. First lawsuit that was filed in Judge Dwyer's court challenged the validity of that regional guide because there was not an environmental impact statement that accompanied it. And that was the first injunction that Judge Dwyer imposed in 1989. He told the Forest Service to go back and develop an environmental impact statement for the regional guide, which they did. And they produced that in 1990 and took it to him, and he said, well, gosh, it's a nice environmental impact statement for the owl, but what about all the other species that depend on older forest? He could have told him that that's what he wanted the first time, but he didn't. So they went back to the drawing board, and he issued an injunction. They went back to the drawing board one more time and produced an EIS on how the spotted owl should be protected in the Pacific Northwest, and it was about that time that it was listed as a threatened species. So enter presidential politics in 1992. Candidate Bill Clinton came to Oregon here, had a meeting with several members of the Carpenters Union in Springfield, Oregon. And he said that if he was elected president, he would convene a conference to try to break the gridlock that was basically brought federal timber sales to a halt in the Northwest and develop a balanced plan that accommodated the economic needs of our region along with the environmental needs. And that conference was held in April of 1993, and in April of 1994, a plan was presented that cut timber harvest levels in the Pacific Northwest by 80%, and set aside 88% of our federal forest lands for non-timber uses. Now go back to my opening statement about the leadership that the state of Oregon has not provided on this issue. Our governor at that time, Barbara Roberts, told our industry that sometimes you just have to play the hand you've been dealt. And that was the response of our state's government to a plan that has decimated rural communities in Oregon and decimated the supply of timber from our federal lands that counties have traditionally relied on to fund their services. Now, the 80% reduction was only on paper because as the plan was implemented during the decade of the 90s, the appeals and the litigation continued. I can tell you, as someone that's been involved in these issues for a long time, the Northwest Forest Plan gave the environmental community more than they ever asked for, ever. But the appeals and the litigation continued. We haven't reached 30% of what the Northwest Forest Plan intended the agencies to sell. 1.1 billion feet was the promise. We've been getting about 300 million feet. So it wasn't an 80% reduction. It was more like a 95% reduction. And that's where we stand today. But there is a huge opportunity here to solve a whole bunch of our state's problems. There's money growing on trees out there, and we don't need to move the pendulum back to where it was. We probably don't even need to move it halfway back. But moving it just a little bit would provide tremendous relief to the timber industry, to communities that are surrounded by federal lands, and the counties that desperately need a sustained and reliable level of funding from those forests. And with that, I think I'll stop and be happy to answer questions when Mr. Barrows is done, because I believe he's going to address one of those huge opportunities that is before us.
Thanks, sir.
Mr. Chair, before you move to Mr. Barrows, do you have written testimony? That's about as succinct a chronology as I've heard delivered, and it would just be very useful for some of us to have it.
We'll have it transcribed off the... We'll get a disc.
Chairman Metzger, Senator Johnson, I'd be happy to put pencil to paper. This was called on somewhat short notice, and I dream about that presentation every night. I have for about the last 28 years.
Very well.
Thank you, Mr. Barrows.
I'm going to leave that line alone.
People dream about different things?
Mr. Chairman, that's my point. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Barrows. It has been my great pleasure to represent the Association of O&C Counties for more than 40 years for this august body. I guess we are ending with clearly the oldest member of the panel. I want to take just a few minutes, if I may, Mr. Chairman, of the committee's time to kind of differentiate the O&C lands from the other federal forest lands, because they are different in mission, in funds provided, et cetera. And for counties like Representative Mowers, Senator Vergers, your county, Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson's county, the O&C monies are a big piece of the puzzle. The 18 counties are all the western counties in this state except Clatsop, which is not an O&C county, plus Tillamook, which is. So it's essentially the west side. And it's an old railroad land grant, as many of you know, probably all of you know. Very checkerboarded. And Mr. Saperstein, maybe in his question and answer period, will talk about what that has meant in terms of how the private and public owners of these checkerboarded lands were able to get together and figure out a way to move their timber across each other's lands back in the 50s, which was critical. Otherwise, they just had little islands of timber that nobody could move. All of them are in Oregon. It's named after the old Oregon and California Railroad Company. They were charged with building a railroad down to the California border and meeting another land grant railroad coming up from San Francisco. And fortunately, they did meet. It was good. Good planning. And Southern Pacific became the owner of the line all the way from Portland to San Francisco. At that point, the largest timber owner in America. They violated the terms of the O&C agreement, and to our knowledge, and we've looked at this hard, is the only case in this nation's history where a railroad land grant was made. The railroad was built, so the federal government got what it wanted out of the deal, which was the ability to move goods and ability to move military. And yet the lands went back to the federal government at Oregon's request. And so these people say, well, we should revert the lands back to their original ownership. Well, the counties, we never owned them. The federal government owned them. A private railroad company owned them, and then it went back to the feds. So that's not an argument that we can justifiably make. The ONC counties contain about 2 million acres, managed 80% by the Bureau of Land Management. They are dedicated by the 37 Act that Mr. Saperstein referenced, which was actually the third in a sequence of three acts. But that was the final one, and it's the one that's on the books today, and it says that these lands are to be managed for timber production. Unlike the national forests, which are multi-purpose lands, the ONC lands and this are to be managed for timber production almost exclusively, with some slight exceptions. And the Ninth Circuit, arguably or inarguably the most liberal circuit in America, has said this on at least five occasions, that these lands are to be managed for timber production. Now, does that mean that's what they're managed for today? It does not, because we got caught in the same Northwest Forest Plan. We had been cutting on a sustained yield basis 1,127,000,000 board feet a year until the Northwest Forest Plan came into existence. And at that point, we were told you can now cut 211 million, and the government has never gotten to greater than 100 million. So we've had a 90% reduction in production off these lands. And that's frankly because every sale is either protested and then appealed. And it just slows everything down, and eventually, and there have been budget cuts in the BLM and all. These are the most productive forest lands that America owns because they're low level. They're down where the railroad bed was. National forest lands tend to be higher elevation, and the soils aren't as good, so they aren't as productive. So we have the finest in the world, and it's just sitting there. And as Mr. Geisinger said, we're just growing trees for the fire of all time. And it is a sad thing. In 1937, it was estimated, without a great crew's thorough analysis, they didn't have the tools in those days, we had about 44 billion board feet of standing timber on the ONC. We have cut a little over 45 billion board feet, and today we have 60 billion board feet. So we have essentially cut the whole thing out, and we have more left than we started with. That's called sustained yield forestry. And there are a lot of people that don't like it. They don't admit it. They say that isn't, we've raped and pillaged the land, cut almost the last of the old growth. That is total and complete hogwash. The BLM has done a masterful job of doing this. As pointed out earlier, I want to talk just for a minute about how the money is divided, because it's very different. On national forest receipts that go back to schools and roads in counties, the money is determined by the amount that's cut in a national forest. And if nothing's cut in that forest, there's no money for the roads or the schools for the counties that forest is contained in. In the case of the ONC, it doesn't matter. The percentage that each of the 18 counties gets is determined by a formula that was developed in 1915, based on assessed value of the timberlands in 1915. And so all the timber can be cut in Jackson County, and everybody gets their little percentage, or none of it can be cut in Jackson County, and they get the same amount. It doesn't matter. That really helps planning. And the other major difference is that on the national forest lands, the federal act says that the money must be divided between roads and schools, as was said earlier, and you all make the decision on how that division shall be made. In this state's case, you have decided that 75% of the Forest Service receipts coming into a county shall be given to roads, 25% to schools. In the case of the ONC counties, again, maybe better timberlands, we were cutting $1,127,000,000 and bringing in, because we get 50% of the receipts, not 25. about $100 million, a little more than that in the salad days. And those monies go to the general fund of the county, unrestricted. So they can help pay for all the services the counties provide. I won't enumerate a list of what they all are. You know them better than anybody. So we could do, as was stated earlier, so much more. And we're in the throes right now, we being all of us that are concerned about the ONC, in a major planning process. The BLM is going through the most detailed, fact-based plan I've ever seen in my 40-plus years with this issue in developing a new management plan for the ONC public domain lands, which is a very small part of the whole thing. Their option number two, their preferred alternative, or alternative number two, would result in a harvest level of a little more than 700 million board feet. Now, when you're going along at 100 million board feet level, that's quite a jump. We're never going back, as was stated earlier, to the billion 127 in our case and whatever the number was for the national forest. It's never going to happen. But we can get a long way with this plan, and you should be aware of that. So we are in the process, the ONC counties, along with many others, of running basically, now we'll bring it right into your committee's bailiwick, two tracks. One is we're trying to get reauthorization of the secure lands program because we need those funds during the time until the BLM does its record of decision, which we hope they're scheduled to do in December of this year. And then there will be inevitable litigation for some period of 3, 4, whatever years, bought by whoever brings it. We may bring a suit. Who knows? But we need that funding base on the reauthorization side, purpose of this hearing, to get us through the period of time until the record of the decision can be implemented. And they can go back to selling what's for some counties, from Lane County South especially, plus Clackamas, are critical in terms of the general fund monies that some of these counties, we're 70% of their budgets. And that is, you take that away, and all of a sudden you don't have any assistant district attorneys, you have nobody to run the jail, there's nobody patrolling the roads. It is a horrifying picture that sounds pretty dramatic. I don't think I overstate it. So I don't know what you all can do. I mean, encourage the BLM. The public hearings or writing comment letters or whatever, that would be tremendous. At the same time, encourage our congressional delegation to continue their great efforts to get reauthorization. And while it affects the secure lands legislation, affects 39 states, school districts and counties in 39 states, Oregon gets half the money. So for us, it's critical. For everybody else, it's important, down to nice. So, glad to answer any questions. I hope you didn't mind, Mr. Chairman, kind of the little reminder of how the ONC is different than the National Forest.
No, I appreciate that, Mr. Barrels, and in fact, not just necessarily for this committee, but for those who listen to these hearings and have an understanding of how this goes together. And I do appreciate that background, and it is certainly the members of the committee are well aware of those impacts, both, as Mr. Geisinger pointed out, in terms of the job retention, community livability, self-determination, the ability to create jobs with the original acts. And then as you articulate, the immediate needs of public services, public safety, transportation, And as we have dealt with this committee on the transportation side, which is a significant part, it's around $100 million in terms of transportation dollars. And when we are considering how we take care of, well, we just heard about Columbia River Crossing, which you heard, but all the myriad issues of maintenance of existing infrastructure, expanding infrastructure, and how we're going to pay for that and get our legislative and public support next session, it doesn't help to be negative $100 million when you're already at a flat line that isn't sustaining transportation and economic growth. So this is extremely important to us, and trying to find a pathway in which we can all kind of focus together to change the status quo, which has been, and your historical perspective, and, you know, we would like to get some significant movement on that before you come for your 80th year representing ONC counties at some, you know, 40-year legislature, that we haven't changed that. So I think that's well-founded, and we certainly hope that this new effort will be productive, because it would answer a number of things, not only the revenues but also restore, well, as the Act said, or the current funding Act, self-determination, which is really the real part of the heart of all this. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Barrows, how can you be so confident that the BLM's allowable cut is going to be as high as you think it is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I'm not that confident. There's a long way to go. There's an interesting dynamic. I mean, there are a number of people who have said $700 million. You guys, what are you smoking over there? Or what is the BLM smoking? They have really done a masterful job of analysis in determining to get to this number. They still in their plan set aside almost half the BLM, the ONC lands, for forest management, but not forest production. So this is not a rape and pillage number at all. I have no idea how this plays out. It obviously has political overtones, but I think it is a very defensible, alternative. We have two people sitting at the table as interveners in developing this plan. One, our legal counsel; another, a former BLM retired district manager who understands how this really works on the ground. And they both believe that this is a very reasonable and doable number. There's also been, and I'll try and do this very briefly, Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Johnson's question, there's been a Supreme Court decision of just a few months ago in which the Supreme Court said that federal agencies, in figuring out how they manage their lands, must look primarily at the charter that focuses their attention on how to manage those lands, and the other things like the Endangered Species Act and the other similar acts are to be very secondary in their focus. I mean, they have sort of said, in terms of the ONC, that timber production this wasn't in the Ninth Circuit, it was in a different circuit, different issue, but this U.S. Supreme Court has put the BLM in a little bit of a box, because the 700 million board feet number may be way too low, because they may have set aside too much. So there are a lot of dynamics pushing and pulling both ways.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ralph, Jim, when you guys were talking about the National Forest Land, I think you referenced that 25% goes to schools. Is that correct? 25% goes to our local schools?
25% of the timber revenues go to the counties. Okay. Of that amount, 25% goes to schools, 75% goes to roads.
Right. So real quickly, what if we were harvesting the national forests at a sustainable rate, how much money would be flowing into Oregon schools from those funds? I mean, if we were managing these forests in a responsible way, those monies were flowing back to the counties, 25% of that money is flowing to schools. How much money would we have in schools available for the state?
Well, if you look at today's stumpage rates and the county was getting 25% of that, say that's $150, and you take 25% of that, I mean, it could be $30-$40 per thousand board feet. And, you know, when you say harvest at a sustainable level, there's lots of different harvest levels that are sustainable.
Give me the highest sustainable rate you could defend.
Well, prior to the court injunctions, we were harvesting 4.5 billion feet of timber off the federal lands in Oregon. Off the national forest
just
lands,
plus our billion.
So you can do the math on that. I mean, the number is huge.
It's in the hundred. I'm trying to do my math here really quickly. Is it 300 million?
That sounds
5.
About.
5.
At least. Yeah. So I think that, and I want to kind of do a follow-up to that. As I understand, the way we do our school distribution is if that flowed into counties with schools, the state, when we redid our redistribution, that's money that actually benefits the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that Portland Public Schools would have a huge financial benefit to schools in Douglas County getting additional revenues, because that'd mean more state revenues would flow into Portland Public Schools. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
This is a statewide issue.
And Chairman Metzger, Senator George, we've talked a lot this afternoon about the timber revenues being shared with the counties, but I would be remiss if I didn't remind the committee that the much bigger economic impact in these communities is when the mill shuts down.
Yeah.
When there's no timber coming, you know, who cares, you know, what the timber revenues are when you start losing employment, payroll taxes, property taxes, the economic activity those mill employees generate in those communities? That's much larger than anything they're getting from the federal government. So when that happens, it's a double whammy.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Verger.
Mr. Chairman, I think one of the things that is so tragic about this is the same song, the 14th verse. It isn't that it happened yesterday and we're scrambling trying to figure out what to do. It's that you've had the voices of very reasonable people that have had a very strong argument in why we should better manage our natural resources. And this has been going on year after year after year, and it keeps falling on deaf ears for those that can really make a big change in it. And I'm not sure of what we can do, but I will tell you that with Curry County facing bankruptcy, with Coos County closing a jail and no one on the road, people are now saying, whoa, wait a minute. Now you're talking about my life and my safety in my community. And maybe that's not all bad. Maybe it will take that kind of uprising, because certainly the people who have been elected from my part of the world and the people that are in the industry have done everything in the world trying to get this turned around. And the sustainable yield, the Elliott, which of course the money goes into the Common School Fund, has been so far below anything. And when you try to talk with them about why that would be, well, you have too many marble murrelet. But the landowners around the Elliott have been allowed to cut. And so the marble murrelet, obviously, like the big old-growth trees that we've been forced to leave in the Elliott. So they all come into the Elliott because they're just the spindly ones left around the horseshoe effect of it. And it just makes absolutely no sense when you try to point out the facts of what has happened that people don't want to be confused by the facts. And so it's a very serious issue, getting more serious all the time. And now you're going to have counties that their roads need to be maintained, and maybe some of them, just like Curry County, will face bankruptcy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, to your point about reasonableness, the unreasonable people will describe the BLM plan as a six-fold increase in timber harvest. The reasonable people will describe it as two-thirds of what they could be producing.
Mm-hmm.
On a sustained yield basis.
Right. Yes. Senator Metzger, Senator Johnson asked a very good question. She asked Mr. Barrows why he thought that he was going to get the $770 million. At the Board of Forestry meeting beginning of January, an icon from Oregon's environmentalists testified and Dave had his association president there, Douglas County Commissioner Doug Robertson, and Andy Kerr told Doug that there was no way that the BLM's plan was going to be adopted. So that's, you know, that's what you're up to. They are prepared to go to court to stop the BLM plan, and they usually are successful.
Well, at some point, and I think Senator Berger mentioned, I think smarter minds, cooler minds, more reasonable minds are going to have to prevail. It's unfortunate that until it actually impacts you in your backyard, your home, your community, that people become more active. You know, it's one thing to have it in, you know, your left brain, but actually to engage the right brain to do something about it. You know, it takes some of those impacts. And one thing I would hope is that, and I certainly am no expert on this. You know, I know what I read and those things that are validated, and it is, I think, becoming more acutely known to the general public as we move for greener standards, lower carbon, other things that we can do as people understand the critical role that working forests play in that. And, you know, the age of trees that are critical time, those 40 to 70 year trees that collect the greatest carbon dioxide, emit the greatest oxygen, and the ability to have those trees means that we have to have a forest that meets a lot of needs and turns over in certain places. As Mother Nature has done with natural causes for many, many years, of which we've mitigated for other purposes. And, you know, with all the right intentions, you know, that we're trying to preserve things, but then we realize that we're not necessarily preserving what's good. You know, we're preserving what Mother Nature had figured out a long time ago, that you've got to recycle and you've got to and make these things work. And certainly with, as we talk about transportation and those dollars and how that impacts and what are the, not only the community livability issues, but what are the carbon impacts of not being able to have rail and we have to have trucks because of other decisions that are made or are impacting, or to be able to have dollars that we can reinvest in other conservation efforts that are generated by using the natural resource base. And that's going to be a critical part. And, you know, I certainly hope that whether it's this plan or some version of that that recognizes the fact that that having these working forests is critical. I know one of the things that was very fascinating that I read in the Oregonian just a few weeks ago, and some of you may have, and talking about how a lot of folks who heretofore maybe have been opposing some, harvesting, you know, of timber, recognizing how important that really is to maintaining the ecosystem. And if you have timber that is harvested in a proper manner, not only allowing other trees to grow and do that, but what about maintaining important tracts of land? You know, we talked about, as Senator Berger pointed out, about private land that's being cut because you don't have access, say to the Elliott. And, you know, we may determine what's state land, what's federal land, what's private land, but whether you're a marbled murrelet or whether you're a Doug fir growing, you don't know the jurisdictional lines. You have a working forest, and those working forests cross geographic lines. And it's like if we're going to go and have a certain policy here, but it creates what we might consider a negative impact here, have we really gained anything, rather than looking at this as an entire working contingency? And then the fear that if we don't have a, especially on our private timberlands, if we don't have access to our federal or state lands, and people are looking at private lands and they're limited there, breaking up the contiguous areas of forest where people say, well, I'm going to just sell this off. I'm not going to manage it if it's not financially viable. Well, that's not in our best interest. I know it's in our best interest to have contiguous forest lands that then are economically viable to be used for that. And if we put people in a position where they can't do that, then they no longer become working forests, and they become resort areas or they become something else, and we become losers all the way around. So, you know, I'm hopeful that this public debate, and I think really with our commitments to greenhouse gas reduction and people realize the role that working forests play in meeting state goals, hopefully will change some of the attitudes that, heretofore have been part of that debate. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I manage a little piece of forest land over in Central Oregon, and we did some highly selective cutting not terribly long ago. Ordinarily, we would have taken those logs to Ochoco. That was a sad thing when Ochoco shut down in Prineville. What about this increased timber harvest? What about the decimated infrastructure? Where will the stuff get processed? Can we absorb enough in what little processing facilities we have left to accommodate a large cut, or do you think that there'll be a resurgence of building mills?
Well, it all depends on what degree of certainty the federal government can provide.
Okay, that answers that.
That volume will be predictable and sustainable. And, you know, administrations come and go, and every time we get a new one, we have new forest policies in this country. And if it takes 80 years or 100 years to regrow a stand of trees on federal lands, we can't be changing policies 25 times during that period of time.
Do we have adequate capacity now?
I think on the east side of the Cascades, it's very, very marginal. You can count the mills over there on probably one hand, one and a half hands. And the non-industrial tree farm people that I think you represent are in a bind because sometimes instead of transporting their logs 25 miles to a mill, they're sending it 150 miles to a mill. That's money out of your pocket.
One more.
Yeah.
Looking at Ralph reminds me of his old employer that has a mill in my district. They just sent out recently a list of all of the mills that have closed since 1993, I think it was. Ralph, I'm sure you saw the same list. And I was stunned as it went on page after page after page, and thinking about the employment base represented by each one of those mills, and those folks now don't do that anymore.
What we're talking about with Mr. Barrell's plan is in Western Oregon, and there is the productive capacity existing or can be ramped up to handle the extra volume. There will be less imports from South America or New Zealand or Russia or Canada.
I know that, and we were beginning to speak more globally. I know which side of the mountains you're talking about, but as we were just sort of meandering into this larger conversation about federal forest management, that was what prompted my question.
Well, I appreciate you enlightening us, and once
thank
again,
you
keeping focus on this issue, and please keep us informed of anything that moves on down the pike on this. Thank you for taking the time. We'll close the informational hearing, and we're adjourned.